Hi. Okay, here in the studio is Clint Barrett.
Hello.
Hi. And we're getting him mic'd up. Yeah.
Is that better?
I think talking directly in to straightforward. Yeah. Okay, now we got
this. Are we all good?
Are we there?
Sound check.
Okay.
Hello. Team.
Hello.
Mike.
All the levels good?
Hello. I don't hear my voice.
Yeah, let me get you.
Hello, hello, hello.
Practicing as we go. Yeah.
It's Freak Radio.
And free and freedom. Free freedom is here. I can hear you?
Because I'm sitting right next to you, I can hear you.
All right, can you hear yourself?
No, I can't.
Those headphones are the greatest.
Hello, 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 hello.
We're down a pair of headphones.
No, I can't.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Send your donations to Freak Radio.
Maybe this isn't plugged in.
Oh, well.
Oh, well.
Things we try.
Is my mic going? Who knows?
We got them all turned.
We're playing musical chairs with the headphones and the microphones.
For hours before we started, and look at that. Look at how it goes.
Yeah.
Every time.
It's live radio.
That's live radio. Okay, so my name is Clint Barrett. I'm a musician, and I'm living the life. I'm living the life of a musician. I'm rather devoted. I'm 59 years old, and I've been playing my whole life, and it's a big deal to me, writing songs, and trying to be relevant, and writing about issues and concerns, and trying to have visions. Songs to me, a lot of songs of mine have been visions, and I think everybody pursues visions. It's like inspiration, trying to find the next stepping stone to your procedure in life and consciousness. You seek an insight, and having the ability to write songs and play an instrument, my stepping stones, a lot of them have been turned into songs. I learned incidentally over the last week that choral has an interest in American Indian culture and ceremonies and stuff, and so do I.
Right.
Yeah.
And you're saying that you came from a background with Hopi and with the Iroquois.
Well, those are some areas of interest of me.
Oh, okay.
There, the Iroquois thing is a background thing, though I'm...
You lived in Taos, too.
I lived in Taos. Well, I'd like to say, when I was a teenager, becoming a full-fledged lifetime hippie in the late 60s, an interest that I had at the age of about 18, 19 was American Indian stuff. I wanted to know more about it. And I read the basic books that were around at the time. Mm-hmm. Black Elk Speaks, Lame Deer, Seeker of Visions. What was the other one? There was one other one that was really well known. A book that a lot of people read. And so I got a sense... I didn't realize it at the time, but as time went on, I found out what it was that I was kind of trying to learn by pursuing that stuff. So this is kind of relevant to the songs that I want to sing here. I was living in Berkeley in all through the 70s, and... And into the 80s, I was living mostly in Northern California. I'd gone to my very first sweat lodge ceremony was with some very serious Indians who were American Movement Indians in 76 at DQU in, you know that place? Deganawa Quetzalcoatl University.
It's up by Davis?
Up by Davis.
Yeah.
It was a Nike missile base that the Indians took over in 70 when they took over Alcatraz.
Right.
And that's where I was told by a producer in Hollywood to go there to a musical concert that was going to happen and that I was invited to play. So I was, I don't know, my early 20s, I guess. I went up there. I was about 25, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. And I walked into a room where there was some very serious older Indian men who were planning the Sundance for that summer. And though it was taking place in a classroom with, you know, little chairs with a little desk on them, you know, all these Indian men, big guys, they were sitting around and they're planning this thing. This is a very serious get-together. I walked in with a pack of Marlboros, lit one up, and I just started to listen, you know, being real friendly, and I had no idea really where I was. The leader of this was Dennis Banks.
Uh-huh.
Who has been a long-time American Indian activist and has led cross-continent walks to Washington to bring consciousness to American Indian issues. Well, at that time, he was on the lam from the CIA for having been part of a crime, or he was a suspect in a crime that happened at Wounded Knee 2. When Leonard Pelletier got busted. And I didn't know anything about this. I was just interested in participating. I found myself on the spot. And as sort of like a humorous thing, and also as a real act of ceremonial respect, which I knew nothing about, I gave Dennis Banks, as the leader of the sweat ceremony that was about to happen, I gave him a pouch of drum tobacco, and I gave him an apple. It was like, for the Indian culture tradition, and for the white tradition, I gave an apple to the teacher, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if he got that or not, but because I gave him the tobacco, in his viewpoint, he was obligated to take me on, even though he was, at that time, seriously running from the cops. He was living in a RV trailer home. Not a trailer home, it was like a RV. It wasn't towed, it was like a big RV. That, who is the actor? Who's that famous actor? Streetcar Named Desire guy? Yeah, Marlon Brando. Marlon Brando had given Dennis Banks a bunch of money to buy himself an RV to stay hid from the cops. And that's how he was doing it. And he happened to have been at DQU at that time, right? And so he was planning the sun dance ceremony. And also, right then and there, they were going to have a sweat lodge. Mm-hmm. That's why I gave him the tobacco. I wanted to be in a sweat lodge. I'd never been in one before. And just going into the sweat lodge, my dog and the dog all the American Indians who were in this, but two, were AIM Indians, and they were armed, and they were deadly serious about doing something that I don't really want to talk about because I'm not perfectly informed, and
that's good.
It's too serious a thing, but they really have an attitude about white guys, you know. I've got light eyes, and they saw me as a white guy, and I was. I mean, I didn't grow up on a reservation. I didn't grow up with Indian culture, any kind of a way. Mm. So we had the sweat, and three people blacked out. It was so intense, and which was really not a good thing for the leader. It's, you don't do that. You don't go that far. I mean, I was a guest, but two other people blacked out. I blacked out, and I was dragged out of the wikia, and I had a vision while I was blacked out. I heard a voice say to me, "Say what's in your heart, and you'll chase evil out of the universe." I was delirious, lying on the ground, having my first sweat experience with these really racist vibes.
Hmm.
And they were racist, and they were holy at the same time, because people were praying in the sweat ceremony.
I get it.
So it was a weird combination of vibes. I blacked out, and then as I'm coming awake, I heard this voice say that, and I thought it meant right then and there to for me to say something. Right? I was delirious,
And so I thought, what a chance, you know? Hurry up, you know, before they pick the next guy or something. You know? So I blurted out, everything is perfect and that's the first truth. That's the first thing that came into my head, right? I was delirious. Everything's perfect and that's the first truth. And when I said that, when I made sound come out of myself, it's like I started coming back into my body. And I this explosion of energy came into me, and I jumped up stark naked, and I started jumping up and down, yelling this at the top of my lungs. There was another sweat ceremony happening with women across this. It was a very large sweat area, and there was another sweat happening with women. There I am, jumping up and down, stark naked, yelling at the top of my lungs in a holy place, right? Not very cool. But I was so delirious that it was like I thought I had the purpose right then and there. I was going to do it. I was going to chase evil out of the universe, right? And I jumped in the fire pit. There were full 10-foot-sized logs that were on fire. And I jumped in, and I burned the bottom of my left foot off. But I didn't burn my right foot. It was untouched. But I really burned the left foot. Mm. And before my friend Gray Horse, who was with me, he had been in the ceremony. He also blacked out. He was part Comanche and part Mexican. And he dragged me out, grabbed me by the hands and dragged me out. Not because he didn't think I should be jumping up and down on the fire, but because I was going to step on a pitchfork that was lying in the fire. He pulled me out, and then I started babbling and just nonsense, crazy stuff. I was exploding, you know. And he brought me back down. And then Dennis Banks' brother filled a shovel full of coals and held them upwind from me. And he made the smoke go across my body. And that smoke, the smell of that smoke was so penetrating that for years afterwards, when the first autumn, like somebody would have a fire and, you know, and the smoke would be coming out of their chimney, and I'd smell that first autumn fire, I'd always go back to that moment when he had that shovel full of cinders and he's putting all that on. Then somebody put on, I had a white muslin shirt, and somebody grabbed it off the somewhere, and they put it on me. And it was like a blessing or something. It was like a baptism, you know, when that white cloth came over my body. And then I started crying. And I just cried. All this energy was just, I didn't know what the hell was going on. Right? So then, you know, they walked me back to my van, and I cooled down, and I was okay. And my friend Gray Horse, he said he had a bunch of rabbit skins. He said, look, we're going to make a bunch of mud. We made a bunch of mud right there, poured water on the ground, made mud, and he plastered it inside this rabbit skin. He tied it around my foot. Huh? That was really cool. It was a really sharp thing to do because it was a mess. My foot was a mess.
Oh, yeah.
The cool mud, right, the earth, it's very, very, very cool thing. So then I think we left the next day, and that was that experience. And so all this time, I'm really interested in the Hopi. This is where the Hopi thing comes in. I was very interested in Hopi culture, and it was easy to kind of like get engaged with them because of that famous Hopi book where a guy named Waters, something Waters, who was a confidant he wasn't Hopi, but he was a confidant of the Hopi elders. They told him the whole story. And you can read it. I mean, it's in a book. It's an incredible story of that they believe that they came out of the earth from out of the Grand Canyon, and they traveled to the four corners of the American continent looking for their home, and then they went right back to where they came out of the ground. That's their belief. And so they were very, very special to me. And across Hopi once, driving to the East Coast, pretty soon after that incident with the sweat lodge, I was still limping. I'd gone to the Grand Canyon, and I was still limping, using a stick, because my foot was really messed up. Mm. And we went through Hopi, and this is the kind of thing, I was compelled to do this. When I was driving through the Hopi reservation, I wanted to give tobacco to a chief or a medicine person or something, you know. But I was too shy to go ask. When I got to the reality, I mean, go knocking on doors and asking questions, it was too much. So I'm driving along, and I just threw another pouch of rum out into the sagebrush. You know, that's the closest I could come. And I had a bag of groceries that I'd bought, and I was driving through a village, one of the mesas, probably, and I saw a woman, and I took the bag of groceries, and I walked from my van up to the woman. She knew exactly what I was doing. I said, "Here, this is for you." She said, "Thank you very much," and walked away. And she knew what I was doing. I was giving an offering, you know.
Yeah.
It was remarkable. So I had that connection. Now, that was about 76. And in about 91, I was living in Santa Fe, I used to rent a space at a flea market there. I'd rent a 10 by 10 foot space for $10, and I'd set up with my guitar, my foot drum, and my harmonica, and I'd sing my songs. And I sang on Saturday. I had a space at a certain spot, and there was people would rent a spot for the weekend, so the same people would show up Saturday and Sunday, right? So there was this Indian woman who was had been next to me all day Saturday, and on Sunday morning, when I got there, she said, "Come here, I want to give you something." And she'd shared some of her story with me. She just ended a marriage, and she was going through deep emotions and changes and stuff. And she really liked my music. It touched her in some way that meant something to her, and she said, "Here, I want to give you something." And she said, "Open your hand," and she placed a chandelier crystal in my hand that was all worn out. It was all the edges were scraped from it sitting in the pocket of Grandfather David, who was a very famous Hopi elder. Do you remember hearing about him at all?
Grandfather David.
Grandfather David. He was over 100 when he went to Copenhagen for a global Aboriginal conference of Aboriginal rights. He was an activist, and he was very well known and liked because he was very funny. He was always he'd always find the prettiest girl in among the bleeding hearts who wanted to help out, and he'd get all the squeezing in that he could, using, you know, "I'm just an old man. You have to help me stand up. I can't squeeze, squeeze. I can't hold myself up."
Yeah.
You
know?
Sounds like Robert Norris. Yeah.
30 years from now. Yeah.
So I knew about Grandfather David, and this woman had, when he would go from Hopi land down to Tucson, where she lived at that time, she would put up the Hopis when they went to Tucson for whatever reason. And he once gave her this chandelier crystal that he'd had in his pocket for years. And it was all scraped from pocket change in his pocket. And she gave me this, and she said, "This used to belong to Grandfather David." And I completely didn't believe her. It was too fantastical. I said, "Is that true?" And she looked at me dead serious. She looks me in the eye and she says, "There's no power in a lie." I got shivers. I thought,
whoa.
Damn, you know, that's for real. And I tell you, that was huge to me, to have received that crystal. To me, was like getting a PhD in what I had pursued in my life, of wanting to be, I wanted to be, and I still want to be, a metaphysical poet.
Yeah.
And,
well, you're a damn good poet, I gotta say.
Well, thanks. So that's where I'm coming from. I just got here from I spent 21 years in New Mexico after being a tried true blood Northern California kid. I was in Haight-Ashbury in the Summer of Love when I was 16 years old as a runaway, barefoot, ripped up jeans, starving. And then I was in Berkeley when the National Guard was dropping
tear gas
on the crowds in
People's
Berkeley.
Park and all that.
People's Park, and I got involved with People's Park, and I was very involved in Northern California. I was born in California, and then I went to New Mexico, which is deep, deep, deep American Indian, American land, American native land, New Mexico, mm-hmm. Utah, the Southwest. It's got this thing. It's got this vibe. And that's where I'm coming from. I'm returning back to what I very much consider the psychedelic tribe that I originally belonged to. So I'd like to sing this song. It's called Where the Raven Flies.
Clint Barrett.
Shadows fall on the edge of night, while the cars all roll in the bright sunlight. Where the chickadees squeak up, squawking people in the sunlit world, the raven opens its beak. Then the shadows sink, purple and slow, before they meet the day. Must grow. Before the lion roars, he will feel a spark deep in the valley from out of the dark. Then the soft doves growl and the owls hiss and the wildflowers sing and the tall pines kiss and the crawling worm eats the mold and rot. While the claws of night eat away what's not. Where the bright sun shines after night has fed, leaves the wildflowers pink out of the purple tent. Where the raven flies when the moon sinks low, many people guess, but nobody.
Right. Thank you. So, in that vein, I've got another song. It goes like this. This is a little louder, so if you're going to need to adjust anything.
Okay.
What they're trying to say, but I'll follow that crooked path of mine myself inside of that beautiful day. I see the green grass rolling underneath the rain. I see the scheme to cast seeds away from pain. The midnight claws that clutch the dreams beneath the stars. I see the sun in the grass where lovers have lain. And that old when I know. If you don't walk the road, I find you dreaming. I'll walk into any old wind that blows. Summer's kiss between the mountains of sex may or may not burn the winter's fire. We are scouts beyond the world and dispossessed. We live our lives walking on a wire. Coyote in the roots of trees is searching. The bond that he left against a Saturday. The morning star rises above the graveyard. The poor winds play.
Oh,
do, then only we will know. Yes, I believe I'm going my way. The morning star and the four winds they play. Yes, I believe I'm going my way. The morning star and the four winds they play.
This is a really a good show.
Mm-hmm.
Just feel lucky.
So I got another song. Should I just keep going?
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you want to introduce or any tell a story about it?
I do want to introduce this one. Are you guys familiar with Seven Arrows? The book Seven Arrows.
That's what I was thinking when you mentioned those other books. Yeah.
Is
that one with a green and gold?
That's right. Yeah, green and gold. It was written by Jaime Host Storm, who claimed he was brought up in a tradition of Medicine Shield painting.
Mm-hmm.
And so the book is a description of a life way. It's like a mystical way that basically says that you're born with one or two or even three of the directions in your being, and you seek what you don't yet possess. So you may... Yeah, like most men have the north, most women have the south, and then some people have the east, beginning initiations, and some people have the west, which is introspection and insight, stuff like that. So I had the extraordinary fortune to have been hitchhiking through Key West, Florida to visit my brother on my way to New Orleans. When he gave me a sailboat, he gave me two sailboats. One was a 10-foot long styrofoam sailboat that needed a sail and a rudder and everything, a paddle. And the other one was a wooden motorboat hull that had a dead 500 horsepower engine that was moored out in the harbor, and he was responsible for it. And he saw a perfect opportunity to get rid of that responsibility, and he gave it to me. So I went out to this. There's these two piles of coral dredgings in off of Key West, on the west side of Key West, where people actually go to what's called Sunset Pier, and they watch the sun go down. And when the sun successfully sets, they clap, which is the funniest thing, you know. But one island, there are piles of dredgings for the big ships in the Second World War for the Navy base that was there.
Mm.
And that one has these big water tanks for storing water on them, right? And the other one had nothing. It was just a pile of dredgings that over the course of 30, 40 years had grown Australian pine trees, which look kind of like evergreen willows. They're really pretty. And... there was, hermit crabs crawling around between the really sharp coral rocks. I mean, you could not walk on that stuff with bare feet. You'd cut your feet up. And I went out there to camp out and sew a sail for my new little sailboat, now that I was a Key West person, right? And so I'm out there, and it wasn't raining. It was winter when I got there. It was winter, so it was raining, actually. And I, my first house, and it was my house for months until summer, I tied a rope between two trees, and I put a plastic tarp, piece of plastic, over the rope, and I put four rocks down. That was my house. And it was about all you needed, really. And so I sewed my sail, and I got that boat working, and then I discovered that I could turn my other boat into a sailboat by putting a mast on it, putting these things called lee boards, which are an outside keel, right? So there I am, living on this island, and I had read Seven Arrows, and I was really into this American Indian medicine road thing, because I was just aching for mysticism. And so I'd read this book, and I had all these rituals that I used to do that were like, I'm just a very ceremonially inclined person. I like ceremony, I like ritual. So I was trying to be a conscious tobacco smoker. So I decided I was only going to smoke inside a circular rope that I'd put on the ground with an opening to the east. I would enter from the east. I would sit in my special smoking place, right? And in my astrology, I was born with Venus on the ascendant, which I figure entitled me to have the name Morningstar. So that's what my name was. I changed my name to Morningstar. And I've done that quite a few times for complex and very effective reasons. I had changed my name, later changed my name to Raven. My name, I ceremonially changed my name to Raven. And this was after I'd written that song about the Raven.
Mm-hmm.
And I had extraordinary experiences that ended after 15 years. My mother once sent me some information. She said she'd read one of these animal medicine books that attributed to the raven the phrase "the unconscious father," the unconscious father. And my whole tragedy of my whole life was that my mother and father divorced, and I was separated from my father when I was about 1.5, and it changed everything. It changed everything, you know. It changed everything for my brother and sister. We were broken people after that, and we had to, you know, put it together. And I chose, just somehow, the Raven. And then she informed me that it had to do with the unconscious father, and it was, in my case, just a very, very true thing. And had all these dreams. I had the events happen around it. It was very real. It wasn't a hokey thing for me, and I'll tell you, it takes a lot of balls to, when somebody says, "Hi, my name's Tim, what's yours?" "Mine's Raven," you know, say, "Okay," you know.
"Can I see your ID?"
It was powerful, and I was into it. I believed in it, so I did that for 15 years, and eventually started paying off. I never quite owned it. 12 acres in the Zuni Mountains in the northwestern part of New Mexico. And I was living out there writing this book that I have written that kind of relates back to that thing about the sweat lodge thing when I blacked out, which had said, you know, say what's in your heart and you'll chase evil out of the universe. Well, I eventually did say what was in my heart. And it's this book. It's called Reptile Conspiracy. And it's on the web as a free download at www.lulu.com/reptileconspiracy. And I mean, this book is a trip. It just sort of happened. It's an adventure story. It's funny. It's sexy. It's not dark, and though it has a pretty dark side to it. And I've got a lot to say about that book. But when I was living out there in the Zuni Mountains, writing my book and living alone, getting over another broken heart, blah, blah, blah. I'm driving along the road one day, and there's these two ravens eating roadkill in the middle of a highway, right? I'm driving 70 miles an hour to my job in Gallup. There's no work out there. This is a place where there's nothing. There's no people. There's no traffic. There's no anything. And I started going up to Gallup, which is an hour's drive each way, to sing in a restaurant for dinner and whatever I could get. And I would usually get enough gas, a six-pack of beer, and dinner from the restaurant, and I'd make it back home with enough gas to get back to Gallup and do it again, right? This went on for a couple of months.
Does the IRS know about this?
They don't need to, man. That's the great blessing of poverty, you know?
That's right. You don't even have to file.
You don't, man. You don't. And nobody can get you for being poor. You know?
Except for the Santa Cruz Police Department down at Peace Camp.
Well, mind your P's and Q's. They won't bother you either.
Yeah.
But so I'm driving along. These two ravens are out there. There's a breeze blowing left to right. And one raven opens his wings, catches the breeze, and flies in a circle over the highway into the woods. The other raven catches the breeze, flies in a semicircle right into the grill of my car. And
ouch.
Kills himself. I'm Raven, and I'm driving, and I just killed a raven, right? Man, did I go through a change. In the next 24 hours, I sold my chainsaw, got enough money to drive up to Durango, And I changed my name back to my given name, Clint, and that was the end of the Raven experience, because I absolutely believed that the Raven had killed itself on purpose to release me from the underworld of the unconscious father.
There you go.
Uh-huh.
Because I had come to a decision about my father. I couldn't talk to him. I couldn't resolve things with him. And I was a mess. I was a mess. I was depressed beyond, it was killing me. The depression was just killing me. I had no drive, no sense of identity, no direction. I was just getting eaten alive by this sadness that had been in my body for my whole life. And I decided I had to amputate my father from my psyche. I had to cut it off or I was going to die. And that's what I did. I cut it off. I said, you can't resolve this. Just leave it behind. Like you would with a gangrene arm. You know, cut it off. Move on. Then I killed the Raven.
He had just realized that, you say. And then the Raven died for you. No, I mean, it just sort of happened.
Just sort of
synchronistically.
Synchronistically. Within a week. 2 weeks, you know.
Oh, well, huh.
How old were you at the time?
Oh, I was, let's see, that was, 96, 97. I was about 47, something like that. Yeah.
Did you ever remember if when you jumped into the fire, you had any memory of if you were trying to cut... do something to purge?
No, I was delirious. Mm-hmm. I was totally delirious. I had no idea what I was doing. And I was exploding with energy right at that point.
And there was no peyote involved in it?
No.
Okay.
No, there was no...
Just checking.
No, you could... I don't think...
It was aim lock, sweat lock.
I don't think you could take peyote and sweat at that temperature. There was a punishing aspect going on there. It was like, there was a lot of anger. And I was absorbing it. And, you know... It wasn't a bad thing because who doesn't want a vision? You know, especially people who are just attracted to that pagan thing, you want a vision. I wanted a vision from the time I was 17 years old. Well, my God, I had one, you know, and I wouldn't trade it, you know. It was pretty cool. So this song I want to sing is called Seven Arrows.
Okay.
What you said was clearly spoken, and she was hanging on your words. But you saw the spell was broken by a songbird that you heard. She laughed that she'd been taken, slid past you into the dark. You called her back, but she was shaking when you heard her laughter bark. And she was seven arrows, turned your words around. Seven arrows put your feet back on the ground. Seven arrows like a tree shivering in the west. Seven arrows still haunts you like a kiss. To the east the bright blade is cutting into the past. The soft south wind is laughing with a new spirit that wants to last. The cold north wind is laughing too at what will dare to stand. And in the west, the waves they crest and dissolve into sand. You said hello, the words will go and leave you to understand. Seven arrows snapping like the crack of dawn. Seven arrows like seven crows all crowing. Seven arrows, the weather of a witch's brew. Seven arrows like a wind just blown through. The walk back home began alone, but then I heard you come. I stayed ahead, nothing was said, but my heart started drumming. The bare branches of a fruit tree clawing at the night, raking off these deadhead hours and leaving what remains bright. You caught me at the corner, my logic could not endure. It's there I caught the fever when I looked straight at your cue. In your seven arrows, the medicine for melancholy. Seven arrows, twisted mistletoe and holly. Seven arrows, just when you don't understand. Seven arrows, you're walking in a magic land. Searching for the parts you couldn't see, and now it's all around you, and what you've done will be. You spoke your words and you were heard, you followed down your clues. You wondered if fate was a true power, now it's walking in your shoes. And you got seven arrows. Seven arrows snapping at your fingertips. Seven arrows speaking out of your lips. Seven arrows singing out the harmony. Seven arrows shooting between you and me.
Clint Barrett, former Raven, Clint Barrett is back.
Some hypnotic voice there. The vibrato harmonics or something. It sounds like two voices going.
Yeah, he has a fascinating way with words and his music, and they intertwine together, and it works with his discoveries of who he is and how the world works in metaphysical language. And wow, what a good happening just to come in. I'm just waiting for a guest, and here he walks in.
We didn't prep at all. We just and I was running low.
I did hear that you did invite him, and you know you've been having this conversation on the Avenue.
You've heard him when I played him, and you heard
him on the Robert Norse Hour marathon show
about 3 or 4 months ago, or something.
Was it a few months ago? How long have you been here since
November?
It's gotta be getting a little better after the 2 months of cold winter weather in the summer.
Boy, that was a shocker.
Yeah.
Especially since I made my living playing music on the Avenue, and I'd hoped to make more than a living, but to be able to make enough to get ahead a bit, and pretty disappointing. Pretty disappointing. But you know, it's okay. Some things happened in the last week that are very. Make things look up really well.
Oh good. Yeah. Well, so, we're in a depression, so that's probably part of it. Do you get hassled on the Avenue for playing at all?
I don't get hassled. I follow the rules, and I also play. I got a lot of respect for people. I mean, I'm playing out in a public space. It's not my space. It's a public space, and I feel a responsibility as a musician, as a poet, as a person, to sing sort of like a place-appropriate music. I don't withhold. I sing all my songs. I don't sing the really nasty sort of social criticism stuff like Cocaine Train. which talks about children dying and people being blown up and blood and gore and guts. And there's children out there, you know, there's young people. Mm-hmm. And they don't understand it. That just sounds like madness to them, you know. So it's like I only do that once in a while just to make sure that I'm doing it. But I like also just singing pretty songs. That's revolutionary, mm-hmm. you know. Making beauty is revolutionary. Singing about love is revolutionary. Making songs about happiness is revolutionary.
Well, want to hear that. Mm-hmm. People are missing, you know, being in touch with what true felt revolutional, you know what I mean, revolutionary kinds of heartfelt music is.
I think so. It's the most rebellious thing there is. I mean, yeah. That's part of the thing that was so magical about the 60s that really needs to be addressed, just like in a way. I mean, you know, like 9/11 is the white elephant that's sort of standing in the center of Kansas right now as the big lie that makes everything else redundant. I mean, we're living in a gauze-covered, you know, fantasy world without talking about that, without mm-hmm. really revealing that as a fundamental presence among us, and that thing was evil. There's mm-hmm. evil going on mm-hmm. there, and it's something that needs to be openly discussed. It's crazy that we're not doing it. Well, you know, there's something that happened. I noticed it at the time because I played music. I'm just immersed in music. In the summer of 70, I used to play on the Avenue in Berkeley, and I just like to briefly point out that people who play in the street who are good musicians aren't in the street because they can't get a gig somewhere else. They want to be there. There's you can address a spiritual state on the street that you can't in a club, because in a club in a closed room, you're if you think about it, if you get a gig, you're being hired by somebody who's paying the rent or the mm-hmm. mortgage. They're buying the beer, they're buying the wine. You're there no matter what else is going on. You're there to pay the rent. You're there to sell beer and wine or coffee. You're there as part of the business. Mm-hmm. When somebody rents property or owns it, they've sunk a root into the Mother Earth. They have property rights. This is a very real mystical thing about materialism. If somebody signs a lease and they're the operator of a property, their vibe is first, your vibe is second. When a musician plays in a club, they're playing on top of somebody else's root. You can't get all the way below their root. And as a musician, a real poet, you have to. You have to have the freedom to sink a root that is strictly between you and the universe for that poetry, vibrationally, to have the power that you intended it to have when you sought out the song, right? Mm-hmm. Well, on the street, you can do that. And in the flea markets, I can do it. Or at my favorite place of all to play is farmers markets, where you can do that too. You can be part of the sun, moon, and stars. You become a voice for the sun, moon, and stars, and that's the point. That's what the poetic act is. That's what I call it. The poetic action. It's the poetic act.
You're talking Freeland talk here. It's so not even eight yet.
This can go on as long as you have songs to sing.
Really? Yeah. Okay, cool. I'll just finish.
That's very good timing, though, isn't it? It's kind of a metaphysical way of looking at free land. Because the show is about that the land should be free. It shouldn't be bought and sold.
Yeah, that follows the show, and it kind of makes an overlap. Yeah.
Okay. I'd like to just finish that little thought then. What I was going to say was that the previous 9/11, in a manner, more poetically speaking than the gross reality of 9/11, the truth of 9/11, is that in the summer of 1970, overnight, out of nowhere, the radio stations of America one day were playing psychedelic music that was a true folk expression of the times. It was a true voice of visionary poets, you know, mm-hmm. All of them. I mean, The Doors, Jimi Hendrix, Dylan, The Beatles, all that stuff were visions, and that's why we still vibrate to them. They give mm-hmm. us life. Well, in the summer of 1970, disco started getting played out of nowhere. It replaced that culture. There's a book called Dark Victory. It's about how Ronald Reagan rose to power and how he sold out the actors in the Screen Actors Guild, of which he was the president, in order to become financed by the movie industry to become governor. In the course of talking about that, they talk about an individual who began promoting disco because what did disco involve? It involved fashions, it involved cars, it involved spending money in bars. It involved, being part of the elite, the ritzy side of life, and the Republican think tanks and the commercial promoters, they saw the hippies wanting to go to back the land movement. Everybody was moving to Northern California and mm-hmm. to Taos. Mm-hmm. Those were the two places that they went primarily, and in Taos there's still the remnants of a commune called New Buffalo, that the land was bought by a doctor in his late 60s who retired, and he bought the whole thing and then called up all the people who used to belong to it 40 years ago, and they had a reunion. It was incredible to be there. All these people that looked, you know, like sort of normal middle-aged people were standing there remembering when they were naked visionaries covered with mud building adobe huts and planting right. corn and, you know, reaching for the stars, right? Well, it's still alive in a different look, right? But in the summer of 1970, suddenly disco got injected into the system by intention. That was aggressively promoted through the media that was more and more becoming a conglomerate of one channel and one station, because they wanted to promote commercialism. They didn't want people to go back to the land and do without. They wanted people to take on mortgages, buy new clothes every 6 months, mm-hmm. buy expensive liquor, buy, right?
Higher and higher platform shoes.
Yep, and ever since then, man, it's like the folk tradition was alive through the 50s and into the 60s. Part of the beats, part of the folk music, psychedelic music was a direct extension of that. And then it ended, and it got interrupted. And it's now, in my instinctual read on this, you see young people now in their everything from 30 on down, they're getting back into the Beatles. They worship all those poets because they're talking about real stuff. They got the vibes. It's mm-hmm. coming alive more and more and more, because all that crap that they've been selling through the movies and through the pop culture doesn't speak to anything. Mm-hmm. It's just people dressed up looking really pretty, they got money in their pockets, and they got nothing to say to each other. They're bored to death with it. It's coming back. And what is going to happen, and I see a parallel to homeopathic medicine. They say in homeopathic medicine that you go backwards through the symptoms of a disease. You relive the disease back to the point where you didn't have it. And I see that happening now with the coming back of the poetic tradition, which goes not just back to the 50s, not just back to the jazz musicians of the 30s and the 40s. It goes back to cave people. The tradition of poetic expression goes back to cave people. It's thousands of years old. Mm-hmm. It's a culture where we, at one point, were the voice of the sun, moon, and stars. And the things that have taken over this voice are this dark materialism that has a very, very serious implications to what is really going on. It's not just psychological aberration. There is dark creativity going mm-hmm. on here, and it needs to be addressed. So I'd like to sing this song that's about something in the general vicinity of that.
Excellent.
I'm going to take this harmonic off. Okay. This song's called... Living in Your Fire.
sacred image, they're hiding in the dark, waiting for that perfect moment when they can add the spark, waiting for that perfect lover or shooting star, to let them know that now's the time to be who they really are. You can talk and talk about it, praising them yourself, but when the party's over, you're still sitting on a shelf. You got lots of buyers, but you don't know what you want to sell. Think you're living in heaven when you're living in hell. Fear is the lie inside that got your heart in chains. Hear the drums of karma pounding, pounding in your brain. The door is right there, it never moves. Time is just how long you wait to walk on through and be living in your fire. From your cup, start with a little spark, and then you burn it up. Is it lust or bucks or love? What's the spell you're under? Show everybody what you wanted to see, but you're still gonna feel your hunger. Come in as Greta Garbo, or maybe a Jesse James, but you gotta lay down your money if you're gonna get in the game. Only you can know your simple honesty when you decide to break the mirror, set your own self free. You lift your hand up, you push the door, you put your foot down, down on the floor. And then you're living in your fire, drinking from your cup. Start with a little spark, and then you burn it up. They got a contract on your face and a fix on your expression. Change the way you walk or talk, they assign you shady intentions. Feel you got your hands tied down, you can't lift a finger to point it right behind your back where the shadows linger. You can see the ghosts out there, but they vanish in the motion. Transparency in the light of day is the tradecraft of their potion. You're at the crossroads now, a sitcom of slick illusions, and your aching heart wants you to end all this confusion. But the drought of forgetfulness will not let you remember that the diamond light you seek is inside your dying ember. You cross your fingers, you lift your head, you break your contract with the dead, and then you're living in your fire, drinking from your cup. You start with a little spark, and then you burn it up.
All right.
That was fiery. I like that one. Clint Barrett.
So I got another song. The Indian thing, I like to just sort of wrap that up in a sweet way.
All right.
We've been happy to interview Clint Barrett here and hear his stories about his songs and what he's been writing about. How many years? 30 years. It's great. Glad to have him.
We'll also be talking a little about metaphysics some more and possibly some politics.
Yeah, sounds good. Okay.
Uh-oh.
Oops. It's all right. It's worth the wait.
raise a feather to the sky to let you know that I deeply love your beauty. I fill my eyes with my own hands, holding my heart stone up into your blue mind. I sound my flesh with my own voice to give the colors back into your rainbow. You're giving me the light of life, and so I make a gift of beauty to make you smile. Sings forever a single pitch of golden flame into red sunshine, whose moon fashions children's lips and eyes like tinted water to see an eye. On the flesh of trees the colors hang in molten flame all down the mountains, while the lake the colors walk slowly out from the sea. That caused my voice to find a song to clothe this naked love. I thank the corners of the world and take your blessings deep into my heart cave. And as the sun rises through darkness, I pray, oh eagle, lend me wings. A feather to the sky to let you know that I deeply love your beauty. I raise a feather to the sky to let you know that I deeply love your beauty. I raise a feather to the sky.